So tonight I'm just going to show a couple of images to start. So I'm going to share my screen. And okay, so can people see that? Do you see an image there? Okay, thank you. All right. So this image is from 20 years ago. I went to meditate in Nepal. And because of political problems there at the time, I was supposed to go with a group of people. I ended up being the only person there other than these little monks that live there and their teachers, and like the head monk who's called a Rinpoche, and workers, you know, who tended to the grounds in this hilltop monastery in Kathmandu, in the hills of Kathmandu. Now this is not advancing. Okay, there we go. So that's the view from that monastery. And during the month I was in residence there, I began a friendship with this. These are the little monks that live there, you know, and that are being brought up to be monks, right? And they were the only ones that were there, these little monks and their teacher, this guy whose name is Tse Wang. And we would spend, you know, during the month I was there, we spent a lot of time together and almost every afternoon sitting on these open fields, just meditating together. And we became close. And he ended up coming to the United States in 2006 on a special visa, you know, as a monk. But because he really didn't speak English at the time and there wasn't a way for him to be a teacher here because of that, he ended up becoming a householder, you know, just a regular person. He took a job. He works on oil rigs as a pump man. He lives in New York. He took a wife who he had never dated. It was one of those arranged marriages from Nepal. And last week, after I got my second COVID shot, and by the way, this is him with the little monks and the areas where we would sit and meditate, teaching Tibetan, you know, at these, so that these little kids who now live in Nepal because they've had to flee from China, you know, from where they did live, so they learn Tibetan. That's us together at that time. Okay. And so because I just had my last COVID shot and I went to visit my mother, who's a New Yorker, and I went to see her, I visited him in New York, now a householder, and met his family. And I wondered, you know, what is this transition like from a monk to a householder? What would this look like? And I was struck, really, this is in his home now, when he's no longer a monk, his wife and his son. Okay, in his home in New York, a very little place in Queens, New York. I wondered how his transition from monk to householder would be. And I was struck by how much the Buddhist path really continued at the center of his life, even though he was doing the same thing that everybody else was doing now. And, you know, he had a difficult, a challenging life. And his living room, which I'm going to show you, is just a little example. Okay. this is what his living room looks like. You know, there's these tankas that there's Buddhist things, and along the bottom here, these are candles that are lit, whoops, that are lit every single day, those candles. Okay. I guess I stopped screen sharing. So the candles are lit every day. And in his, along that little thing that you saw, there's like seven or eight bowls that are filled with water that are changed every day. Okay. And people pr and the family prays together every day. You know, there's a whole chanting thing that they do. And I'm really struck by that how he punctuated his life with these daily reminders about what was really important. You know, not the oil rig and, you know, all the things you had to do to maintain life, right? But this path. And I saw a daily life that was used in a way to further the path that many of us are on, rather than a meditative practice centered on furthering daily life, which is how a lot of us start our practice. I'm going to do meditate so I can be less anxious, so I can relax, so I can do my job better. Okay. This is the way many of us started to meditate, and some of us are still there. But there's a shift that happens. I know that they've asked me at NAU, the basketball team wants me to teach meditation so they can better sink foul shots. Okay. All right. On one level, there's nothing the matter with that. That's useful, okay, to be able to sink foul shots and be calm enough to be able to do that. Sure, meditation can help you to cope with everyday life and to do everyday life better, and that's fine. But the problem with this is something we miss in this culture. And that is, how likely is this understanding going to lead me to a really satisfying life? And the Buddhist answer would be, I think not likely at all. Okay. And I say to myself, do I really see this? Am I really getting this? Where is my attention when I wake up in the morning? What dominates my consciousness? Is it simply all the stuff I have to do to make my life work? Okay. So how do you answer the question? Did you have a good day? Did you have a good day? The conventional ways that we answer this is that, you know, we survey the mental states that maybe that we experience today and the conditions that might have given rise to those. Oh, it was a great day. I was off work. I took a walk in the woods. And I would say that even though I consider that walking in the woods a great activity, okay, I still answered the question very conventionally because it was a pretty day. I got some good exercise. My body is tired now and relaxed. Okay, that's fine. But look where your attention is focused. It's on pleasant conditions. Being with things that I want, not having things that I don't want. Okay, I'm for that. That sounds good to me, right? Having things I want, not having things. But the question that for us is on this path is that it? Is this the way? Do I have a good life by just piling up one good day like this after another? Is that what having a good life is? I would say it's important to see that this, in a way, is our delusion. That finding worldly happiness, Finally, finding worldly happiness is lovely. I agree. But it's temporary. And it's a surface thing that has particular characteristics. When it fades, that good day, or I lose it, I become unhappy. It doesn't stay for long. Today, I may have to work and take on a problem I didn't want, or on my day off, it's miserable out, or my new car has a dent. Now, this is life, right? People who study this, this idea of happiness, say that the majority of our life experiences register as neutral. And most people have an approximately equal number of pleasant and unpleasant experiences. So let's give it a percentage just for conversation purposes. Let's say 60% of all our feelings in life are neutral. Okay. We get 20% that are negative with negative conditions and 20% that are positive. Okay, and that's our life. And even if when you have a really positive thing happen, it lasts maybe 3 days is what they say. I mean, even like the best thing, my book just came out, yay, 3 days I'm happy, okay? And then something else happens, right? Does it make sense to spend your whole life chasing the 20% of experiences at this level that are going to be positive? Does that make sense? Ignoring or dissatisfied with 80% of your life? What if you truly believed that only 20% of your life, no matter what you did, okay, no matter who you are, would ever fall into the pleasant category? And yet, you still want a happy life. We all want a happy life. But what if that's really true? Only 20% of our life is going to be these positive things. What do we do? Okay. If we believe that, probably, I would have to say, you're probably not going to worry so much about collecting happy moments if you really saw that. And here is where I think that Buddha or Buddhist practice is pointing us to look at it this way, to start saying, how do I be happy? How do I become happy under these circumstances? They're pointing us to see the limitations of worldly feelings so clearly that we're no longer fooled by the seductive force of them. And we don't spend all of our life energies just chasing after them. Another pleasant moment, another pleasant moment. It's hard, you know? It's hard to get this. It's a challenge for people, not only now, but in all times and cultures, especially if you're a householder, like, you know, and not a monk. Right? Especially if you have to do all these other things in life. So, you know, listen to this poem, okay? Different culture, different time period. It's a poem from a famous Japanese poet who happens to be a woman, which is very unusual, more than 1,000 years ago. Her name is Azumi Chikubu. She's a mid-Heian Japan around 1100, I mean, about 1000 AD. She's the daughter of a governor. You know, she's not a monk. She's not a nun. She's outspoken. She's scandalous. She has affairs. You know, she's a highborn woman, powerful, but Buddhist. Okay, she's a Buddhist. Her poem is called Although I Try. Although I try to hold the single thought of Buddha's teaching in my heart, I cannot help but hear the many crickets' voices calling as well. Do you see what she's saying? What are the crickets' voices? They're the worldly things and feelings related to it. All the daily stuff, right? I cannot help but hear it. And I think, wow, she's writing 1,000 years ago. This is the same problem I have. I cannot help but hear the cricket, you know, but hear the cricket's voices calling. She would be, as Buddha puts it, a consciousness that still follows the drift of signs of the forms of the world. Okay. And I find I do that. I have to keep being aware that I'm doing that. Oh, I'm just following the signs of the world, you know? What do I think about when I get up in the morning? Am I thinking about all that stuff of the day? When I ask you, how was your day? What are you looking at? Are you looking at the many crickets' voices calling? Or are you looking at something else? So the Buddha is asking us to keep looking at the limitations of the crickets' voices. But he also offers something else. And what he offers is learning to recognize the happiness instead in what he calls unworldly feelings. Not the worldly stuff, the worldly feelings, the unworldly feelings. What does he mean by that? He means unworldly feelings, the peace of presence, the softness and warmth of loving kindness, the connection of compassion, the self-acceptance when you have wholesome intentions, the comfort of right effort in life, the release or the freedom of what they call a lot renunciation. It doesn't sound so good, but of giving up things, of letting something go. That is often a feature of worldly feeling, that I'm grasping onto it, of just letting it go, that feeling. They're often more subtle feelings, but they're drowned out by these worldly ones. Okay. And he's saying, find these to get closer to real happiness. Begin to see them. So here is the same poet. Okay, Izumi, in another poem, as she wrestles with this worldly and unworldly stuff, but she takes a further step. So listen to what this one sounds like. And it's called, If the One I've Waited For. And remember, she has all these affairs and coming to her, right? If the one I've waited for came now, what should I do? This morning's garden filled with snow is far too lovely for footsteps to mar. Did you hear that? Do you hear the balance shifting for her? If the one I've waited for came now, what would I do? The morning's garden filled with snow is far too lovely for footsteps to mar. What is she talking about? The worldly feeling of her lover versus the unworldly feeling of the untrodden snow. And for the first time in her poem, she's starting to see the problem in the worldly desire. Okay? And what they take away from you, he's gonna make footsteps in this beautiful snow, right? She's starting to see the loveliness of the unworldly, the peace and beauty of things that are untouched by the worldly stuff. Okay, she's starting to get it. So we can get it too. We can find this unworldly to in all kinds of things as our practice matures, and we'll see it more and more clearly as you know, with our practice. Let me give you a less poetic example. There's a piece of scrumptious cake. So the question, what brings more happiness? Having the second piece of cake, the worldly feeling, right? Or being mindful of wanting it and being able to let it go. Okay, do you see the difference in the feeling? And once you experience really clearly this feeling of, you know, the other feeling, you begin to get the power of it. And that's when really for like the cake, dieting and willpower leave the picture. You don't need it anymore. You have this feeling, this good feeling that happens when you let it go and you feel that release of not being strangled anymore by the desire of it. So instead you have the happiness of the unworldly feeling, often letting something go of something desirable, or sometimes on the other hand, this deep acceptance, which is letting go of the fighting when something undesirable is happening and just letting go of the fighting with it. And those two things give, you know, will begin to orient you toward these unworldly feelings. You know, when I work in the jail, one of the exercises I do in one of the course segments is, because there's a lot of people there who have addiction, okay? And I bring chocolate, which is not allowed. It's contraband in the jail. But they let me bring it in, this really good chocolate, into the jail. And everybody gets a piece and they get to eat it. And then I give them another piece. And they take it back to their jail cells. And I say, try to sit with this feeling of wanting that and get the power that you have of not having to eat it right away. You can eat it tomorrow, you know? And I teach once a week. And when I come back the next week, there's a lot of people who haven't even touched it the whole week because it felt so good to be able to give up the chocolate and to see what that felt like, right? And I realized they get it, you know? Could they maybe apply that to something even more important, their alcoholism or their drug problems, you know? And people talk to me about that over time. And it's that same thing of being able to have that feeling that's good. And as soon as you feel it, the feeling of letting go and, oh, wow, I'm not grabbed by it anymore. It's such a power. Okay. One of my most powerful experiences of unworldly feelings was in the middle of being sick. And when I was able to release the hold of the sickness so that the sensations of being sick were not the only things in my consciousness. And I was able to have some other experiences other than just being sick at that moment. And I realized, oh, I had this space around this. I could see other things there beside the sick sensation. And then I could see the sickness as just a little part of me. And also changing and not me anymore, just a little passing thing. It was so freeing. It made me laugh in the middle. I mean, I think I was on the floor, you know, hanging my head over the toilet and I was laughing, you know, it was a great feeling. You know, and I suggest with those of you who are doing COVID shots, right, in the middle, maybe your second COVID shot is a great opportunity for this. You know, you know, that the symptoms, if you have them, are only going to last 24 hours. So play with it. See if you can be mindful within this and see the feeling of just letting go of this sickness, or at least a little bit, so that you have a little freedom within it. Can you apply it tonight to the pain in your knee when you sit? Yes, of course you can move, but moving is the worldly response, right? It hurts, I'm going to move. It feels better. That's okay. Nothing the matter with that. But if that's all that you do in a sit, you've got other possibilities, right? Than just keep moving your knee. The unworldly response is to release the attention and the proliferating thoughts about the knee and notice the freedom and the power that comes from that. Okay? Play with these things. Making unworldly feelings the default in our lives or even more prominent, seeing them, experiencing them more clearly will advance our practice, but it will also add to the quality of our lives. You know, when Alan and I, you know, Alan, some of you, Alan Atkins, when we teach the 6-week meditation class, invariably people report boredom in their sitting as a big obstacle. And sometimes they don't sit their intended time period because they're too bored, right? You know, we know that it comes up in meditation. And I love how Alan responds to this because it's really true for him. He says, I love to be bored. He's serious. How could you love to be bored, right? And really, what he's talking about is the unworldly feeling rather than the automatic acting from restlessness where you get up, okay? I'm too restless to sit. He loves to see how restlessness plays on his mind and then how it releases, his mind releases into intense interest in how the boredom is playing on him, you know? And so it becomes really interesting. So he can say, I love to be bored. And it's really, that is a true expression of unworldly feeling. Because no one in the world would really feel that, right? It's something else. So by learning the distinction between worldly and unworldly feeling, by contemplating it, playing with it, getting clear around it, we're offered the opportunity to replace our endless search for happiness in the world of impermanence and dissatisfaction, really, with a happiness that's born of the heart, that comes from within, that does no harm, that increases the growth of wisdom, and that spreads our acts of compassion and generosity. And this feels like a tipping point. So let's tip.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.